a student of mine named Derek. And Derek wrote this poem at a retreat that I taught that he was at last winter. And so at that time he was 17 years old and had, this was I think probably his fifth retreat, and he also had about a year in recovery. And this was one of his, I like to think of it as one of his kind of enlightenment poems that came out of this retreat, his spiritual awakening poems. He gave me permission to read this and say his name. I spent a lot of time trying to be offensive, a lot of time trying to be defensive, but who was offended and who was I defending? When you start to see nothing unordinary in all of the eyes, when you start to see that it is only yourself, there is a whole lot less to fight against. Only yourself. There's a whole lot less to fight against. And we also know that there's plenty to still fight against with only ourselves. So what I want to talk about tonight is humility and the seventh step. And humility, I think, is very much in the same category as Kevin was talking about with the right effort last night. Great term, sounds pretty concrete, but again, like Kevin, I think I'm going to be the finger pointing to the moon there, because with a concept like humility, we can talk around it forever, and that's useful, and I will, but it's really something that the fruits have to be tasted directly. And like so many things, we can have a taste or a glimpse, and that's the beginning of the path. And then the way that I think about it is there's like a taste of humility or a taste of right effort, like Kevin was talking about last night. There's this taste, and then there's this possibility of relaxation around the taste. Because when we taste it, then we're like, aha, or at least if you're anything like me, humility's been a real edge for me in my program all these years, all my programs. So I reflect on it a lot, I teach about it a lot. And how many times have I had a deepened sense of humility and gone to a sponsor or a friend and said, aha, I got it, I know I got it. Only to fall flat on my face into self-pity and like, you know, status seeking the very next day. Where did it go? So we get a glimpse, right? And then we relax. And with the relaxing, there's possibility for that glimpse of humility to spread and to merge with all the things that impede us from humility. And it just merges farther and farther until nothing's left out. And I think that that's what they call a spiritual awakening. At least in my experience. So the seventh step, formal words of the seventh step, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. It seems to come out of me more naturally these days, more like humbly asked to have my shortcomings removed. So I like it both ways, but I also like to play with language. I know some people it's very sacrilegious to be playing with the language of the steps. I acknowledge that. It's the way I learn. So maybe it's the way some of you learn also. The Buddha taught the teaching on the middle way that Kevin was talking about last night, the Eightfold Path. And I wanted to tie that into this teaching on humility. And so in one of those big fat texts that Kevin was rolling around last night, I didn't feel like carrying mine, so I just typed it out here. There's this very important sutta called the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma. So it's the turning of the wheel of the truth or understanding the harmony of the truth of the way things are. It was the first important teaching of the Buddha after he had his fundamental spiritual awakening. He said, "There are these two extremes that ought not to be cultivated by one who has gone forth." So, gone forth on the spiritual path. What two? There is devotion to the pursuit of pleasure and sensual desires, which is low, coarse, ignoble, and harmful. And there is devotion to self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and harmful. The middle way, however, avoids both of these extremes. It gives vision, it gives knowledge, and it leads to peace. So what is this talking about? Devotion to the pursuit of pleasure, to self-mortification. I like to think about it as moving beyond our addiction to entrancement and avoidance. So on one hand, there's the entrancement, the longing, the wanting. If I just get that hit of whatever, then I'll be happy. Simple enough. And then the other addiction of avoidance. If I can only get rid of fill in the blank, then I'll be happy. And we all know that one trait we carry in common as humans is we all want to be happy. So we do all these things that we do to try to find that happiness. We get addicted to these habits. So the middle way is talking about a possibility of beyond addiction to the entrancement and the avoidance, and kind of a place that is not in the addiction to the self-absorption. I kind of think of it as the addiction to me, the all about me-ness. So I've said this many times that when I first heard about that teaching, my very first response to that was boring. You know, I love extremes. I want to be entranced. Carry me away, you know? And being having a very strong aversive habits myself, it's like, hey, if I can't say, get out of here, how can I be okay? You know, that's my power, that get rid of energy. So it was a challenge for me. One of my favorite quotes these days about this teaching is from Ajahn Sumedho, who Kevin read from this morning. He's the abbot of Amaravati Monastery in England, and been a monk forever, and a very wise being. One of the things I appreciate about him the most, though, having sat a number of retreats with him, is his ordinariness. So he's this heavy-duty head honcho of, like, the Theravadan tradition, you know, been a monk for, I don't know, 40-plus years. He really could have quite a chip on his shoulder, and he's just so normal. He's just the most normal person you ever met, even though he's walking around wearing a sheet, and he's bald, and it's just, he's so ordinary. So he says this. We tend to create personalities out of our thoughts, which are based on extremes, which make us neurotic. This is a practice of not going to extremes. Extremes of, I want this, I don't want that, not making problems out of things. Not making problems out of things. To me, that's the turning of the mind of awakening. Something happens. Am I making a problem out of it, or can I let it be as it is? No. Doesn't mean that we condone actions that are harmful, but if they've already passed and we're dealing with the results, am I making a problem out of it? Maybe 50% problem, you know? It's not all one way. 85% problem, 15% no problem. So, humility, what is humility? It's a question that's often asked, actually. What is humility? And my favorite definition of humility comes out of the OA 12 and 12. An awareness of who we really are today and a willingness to become all that we can be. Genuine humility brings an end to the feelings of inadequacy, the self-absorption, the status-seeking. Humility places us neither above nor below other people on some imagined ladder of self-worth. It places us exactly where we belong, on an equal footing with our fellow beings, and in harmony with God.
Would you mind reading it again?
Absolutely. An awareness of who we really are today, and a willingness to become all that we can be. Genuine humility brings an end of the feelings of inadequacy, self-absorption, status-seeking. Humility places us neither above nor below other people on some imagined ladder of self-worth. It places us exactly where we belong, on an equal footing with our fellow beings, and in harmony with God. So this is both an inspiration and totally terrifying at the same time, because exactly where we belong, on equal footing with our fellow beings, can I feel my own okayness when I'm not trying to be above or below you? And then in harmony with God, that which is greater than ourselves, you know, am I good enough to be in harmony, in intimate relationship with something that powerful? I was talking to a mentor a while ago about humility, because as I said, big theme in my spiritual practice. And I was going through a mega cycle of inflation and deflation, which is my favorite way to categorize the selfing that happens that bounces me out of humility. So inflation, deflation. And I remember saying to him, you know, like, humility, why? You know, I knew it was a good idea, but I kind of just lost that connection. And I loved what he said, and so I remembered it. He said, Heather, humility, because in every direction you turn, there is fire. Humility, because in every direction you turn, there is fire. And I thought, huh, what's he mean? What's he talking about? So I've used it as a contemplation since then. And really learned through my own direct experience my own interpretation of what he meant. And, you know, that is that the Buddha actually talked about these fires, right? If you're looking at the inflation and deflation, he talked about the fires of greed and lust and obsessive wanting, and the fires of aversion and fear and anger. You know, and then the fire of the self-absorption and the ego, you know, the egoness and the status-seeking, and it's all about me. You know, in the teachings, these are called greed, hatred, and delusion, just to keep things simple. And sure enough, you know, we know in the big book and how it works, it talks about how we feel burned up by our resentments. You know, and it's true. I mean, when we're burning with a resentment, ooh, it's hot. It feels hot. So humility is one of the main cooling elements of these fires. Whether you're in 12-step practice or Dharma practice, either way. The way that I like to think about it is a pendulum. So I noticed I was wearing this, and I figured, okay, this will work as a pendulum, because it's easier to show you than to say it. So there's this pendulum of inflation and deflation. The inflation says I'm the best thing that ever happened. Or, you know, Hutchins Tomato said it really well, that quote that Kevin was reading this morning. Let's see if I can find it here. Okay, so inflation. If you think you're the best, the greatest, God's gift to the world, by Hutchins Tomato. Inflation. Deflation. Or if you think you're the absolute bottom of the stack. Deflation. Actually, I'm going to finish this quote because it's great. Or if you don't know who you are or what you want, or if sometimes you think you're superior, but sometimes you think that you're inferior. All these things change. So there you have the pendulum swinging. So you have inflation and deflation, and it's swinging. And at either extreme, there is heavy-duty charge. And charge captures our attention. It's interesting. It's the glittery lights of our internal experience. Oh, I'm great. Oh, I'm a piece of whatever. It captures our attention. It glitters. Ah, let me go live there for a little while. And it just swings and swings and swings. So it's like, here's the pendulum, and here's the action of it swinging. And I'm feeding it with this action. And it'll get wild and more wild and more wild, back and forth. I'm the greatest thing that ever happened. I'm the worst thing that ever happened. Best meditator ever. How did I ever get on this retreat? They should kick me out. You know, I mean, it goes on and on and on, right? But what you miss, because you're so busy tracking all that crazy movement, is there's this middle place. Now, if I just sat here for 5 minutes and held this without moving, we would get awfully bored. I mean, I know we are on the second day of the retreat, so things are more interesting at this point, but we'd get bored. So I won't do that. But I was playing with this this afternoon in terms of the pendulum, and here's what I noticed. It's like, let's say it starts swinging, okay? It gets going. Yep, best meditator that ever lived. You know, they should put me in charge of something. Swinging, swinging. Oh man, I totally blew that one. I should never be teaching this retreat. Okay, swinging, swinging, swinging. Now I'm not feeding it anymore. See how it's turning in little circles now as it stops swinging? I was thinking about that as the turning of the wheel of the Dhamma. Little circles. And that just stops. And then there's space and stillness and presence. And that's what happens when we don't feed. You know, when we don't interfere. We are going to fly into inflation and deflation. We are going to get caught in 5,000 judgments. It's part of being a human being living a life. In fact, the Buddha said that until you reach the very last point before you become 100% enlightened, whatever that means to you, you will have judgments. You will be going into the I'm better, I'm less, you're better, you're less. So if you're doing that, it just means you're not 100% enlightened. Welcome. And, you know, there is this possibility of rest in the middle. It's not as exciting, but there's something there. And we all know it, or we wouldn't be here. We'd be off doing something more externally exciting. So the pendulum. Humility is this neutrality. It's not addicted to the charge of inflation or deflation. It's, I actually think about it as a little death. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. The third step prayer says, release me from the bondage of self. And I think of humility and the process of deepening into humility as these little deaths. And I think what it is that we're asked or invited or thrown into dying to who we think we are, into who we really are. Both the greatness of that and the smallness of that. And so we die to our ideas that kept us going through all of our addiction cycles, so that we could actually stay alive through those acting out of addictive cycles. We needed those identities to survive the addiction being acted out. You know, and now we're coming into deeper and deeper freedom from the addiction. And so those who we think we are places start to die. Their life cycle passes away and into who we really are. Ajahn Chah, who was Ajahn Sumedho's teacher and a great Thai forest meditation master, has a saying, to die before you die. And I really think this is what he means. To die before you die. It's really easy to think that we had one birth when we popped out, and our baby, and one death when our body dies. But then there's this dying before we die, you know, and being born, too. So why is this so hard? You know, why is it so hard to be so honest and look at ourselves so honestly? And, you know, why is it so hard to be willing and have the conditions possible to release and transform these so-called character defects or shortcomings? I was also reflecting on why we might want to keep our shortcomings. I mean, if they weren't useful, we would have let go of them already. So talk a little bit about that. I have a whole practice that if I was going to give it a name, which I usually don't, I would probably call it honoring character defects practice. And the reason why I have it is because both through my own work and working with so many other people, I have to honestly say, I don't think I got this insight through my own practice. I think I got it through being of service and listening to so many others, both in the Dharma scene and the 12-step scene. These character defects, I really think that most of them saved our lives and our hearts, you know? And that's why I have a practice of honoring them, because they saved our lives and our hearts at a time when we didn't have any other strategy available. If we'd had another strategy available, we might have tried it, but we didn't. And so in order to protect a little piece of our heart that might be able to survive to the point when we grew up enough, got enough recovery, developed enough tools, cultivated more support and fellowship, that heart could, you know, be uncovered and live again. Most of our shortcomings are strategies to protect our sense of self, you know, in our hearts. And mostly they're habits, you know, and they were just created by the conditions that created them. And it might have been a dysfunctional family where I learned this habit of putting up the concrete bunker in front of my heart, because otherwise I was going to get decimated and I wanted to save part of my heart, you know, or I could go on and on with what the habits are. You know, we've all got our habits. And then what happens, of course, is that we continue to feed them, right? We feed them with our attention, we take them seriously, whether it's the I'm not good enough, I hate myself habit, you know, we keep feeding them with our attention, and then they manifest in our actions and gain even more power and validity, and then they keep living. not making problems out of things. That's just how it works. Yeah. Interesting quote by Pema Chodron. Trying to fix ourselves is not helpful. It implies struggle and self-denigration. Denigrating ourselves is probably the major way that we cover over bodhicitta. And bodhicitta is awakeness of our heart-mind. Is the major way we cover over our bodhicitta. So that's an interesting quote. You might agree with it or not. You don't have to agree with it, but it's interesting to reflect on. So if we're not going to try to fix ourselves, then what are we going to do? I mean, I have to say, both in Dharma practice and in the 12 steps, this fix-it habit is strong. If I just meditate enough, if I just do another 4th step, you know, maybe I'll be okay. Maybe. So first I want to say something about fear. Because both in terms of why we might want to keep our shortcomings and what are we supposed to do if we're not fixing it, I think fear is key. And, you know, sure enough, 4th step in the big book, this short word, fear, somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. Yeah, we know this. It's pretty basic. So how to work with that fear that feeds the addiction to me, you know, being the greatest, being the worst, being anything. I really think that this practice of naming or mental noting is key in forming a relationship with not just fear, but I've personally found it really useful with fear, but any of these challenging emotional states, you know, your fear, your shame, your anger, your loneliness, everyone's got their own preferred flavor of challenging emotional mental state. So why do we use the mental noting? Is that number one, you know, this stuff is living in us, obviously. And so when we're moving through our lives, whether it's on the cushion or off the cushion, we're allowing our mental capacity to be involved in the process. We're basically giving our minds a job. Because otherwise, our minds are going to fly off into the stories about me or about you, and they're going to be off and running. So if we use this naming practice or noting practice, we're actually letting the mind be involved in the process. We don't have to give ourselves a lobotomy to do this practice. Not required. And there's an intimacy there. Instead of being enslaved to the way our minds operate. You know, we know this from our addictions. If we're enslaved to the insanity of our minds, we're about to go pick up whatever, we're real close. And it's like, breaking the chain of the enslavement. Let's see, I have a poem for you somewhere. It's by Wendell Berry. I go among trees and sit still. We're doing that. All my stirring becomes quiet around me like circles on water. My tasks lie in their places where I left them, asleep like cattle. Then what I am afraid of comes. Then what I am afraid of comes. Yeah. Why do we keep going at breakneck speed and keep doing all the things we do to hold out that what I'm afraid of comes? And we come here and we sit among the trees, and our to-do list is at home. And sometimes, you know, what we're afraid of comes. I remember quite clearly one of my early 2-month retreats. And I had this, I was in my early 20s and hadn't been sober nearly as long, although already pretty long. So I had these habits of extreme meditation. And one of my habits of extreme meditation was that I would sit up in the hall like way in the wee hours of the morning, like hours after the last yogi had left. And so if you want to talk about humility and inflation and deflation, you know, here's the honest truth about what was going on. I don't actually think I've ever shared this, but the honest truth about what was going on was, number one, I wanted to be the last one in the hall. Number two, that feeling of pride of, yep, I can just sit here forever. And I could, you know, I could. But number three, there was so much defense still put up in my system that even though we were silent for weeks and months and no one talked to me and I was totally allowed to be with my own process, still, the defense was so great that the only time I could 100% take off that Heather mask was alone at that hall at 2 a.m. with no one else there. And so I needed that time. Because when I took off that mask, what I was afraid of came. And it came every night. And I sat with it every night. And it was just this visceral terror. And the hall was dark and there were weird noises. And there was this terror. And so I would sit with it and I really took refuge in the wisdom of the Buddha. And what the Buddha did when the fear came, when the lust came, when the doubt came, he called that those challenges Mara, this archetypal, energetic, metaphorical being, Mara, you know, our demons. And the interesting thing about Mara and the Buddha is that even after the Buddha was fully enlightened, Mara still came. I find this fascinating because this is what it tells me. I don't have to fix all of my emotional states, perhaps not even all of my so-called character defects, in order to fully wake up. Here's what the Buddha did when Mara would come, whether it was the Mara of fear, actually the Mara of doubt often came to visit the Buddha, even after his enlightenment, you know. Who do you think you are sitting there teaching that the multitudes of people and they're all getting enlightened? And the Buddha would just nod, see that Mara was there, and say this simple thing. I see you, Mara. I see you, Mara. So you see how this ties in with the naming or the mental noting practice. I see you. I honor your presence. And now I'm sharing presence with you in me. Right? He actually took it one step further, as the story goes, and sometimes Mara would come, even after his enlightenment, and he'd invite Mara to tea. Say, Mara, come on in, sit down. Are you thirsty? Have some tea. And, you know, they'd be pouring tea. And, I mean, you can hold this as a real thing with two bodies or a metaphorical thing or both. I hold it as both. They're pouring tea. Here, have a biscuit. Thanks. How you doing, Mara? You know, who do you think you are being the Buddha, getting multitudes of people enlightened? Oh, yeah, Mara, I see you. Yeah, have some more tea. Yeah, okay. How you doing? Well, actually, you know, it's not so easy being Mara. Nobody likes me. They're always trying to get rid of me. You know, it's not so easy being Mara. And I love the Buddha's response in this one story. The Buddha turned to Mara and said, yeah, you know, I totally hear you. It's really not so easy being a Buddha. You know, everyone's always like wanting my advice and people are trying to kill me and I'm trying to, like, keep peace in my country, and there's, like, war about to happen. It's really not easy being a Buddha either, and they just nod. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that we can relate to our shortcomings that way. With that simple phrase, when what I'm afraid of comes, I see you, Mara. have some tea. You know, sit with me for a while. Join me. Show me your face. Tell me your story. Let me know you completely so that I will never get lost in your web of deception again. You know, because we're as close as my own heart. I see you, Mara. Then what I'm afraid of comes. I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song. That's how the poem ends. I think another really important skillful means in terms of working with these elements of selfing and inflation and deflation that obscure our natural humility is a sense of humor. Because it's so excruciating. I mean, someone came in the first day and said, you know, my thoughts are driving me nuts. If I, you know, they didn't actually say this, but my version of it is, if I have one more thought, I'm going to just run out of the room screaming, you know, because it's just this incessant judging and telling stories about ourselves and who we are. And it's just exhausting. Someone else came in and said, I'm exhausted by this. So I think a sense of humor is important. And again, I'll share one personal skillful means. It goes with a story. And the story is that a number of years ago, I broke my foot. And so I was up in my bedroom, which is in the third story of my house. And it was before the point where I could navigate the crutches up and down the stairs, which were really steep, and there were two flights of them. So I was on the third floor. Fortunately, I've done so many retreats, I'm like, okay, I'm on retreat. This is my meditation area. Here's my bed. My walking practice is to see if I can make it from the bed to the toilet and back. And that's it. I was up there for 3 weeks. At some point, it was a very painful injury. And at some point, I just really fell into despair. And I fell into self-pity. And I fell into judging. I was judging myself for being such an idiot to trip down the stairs in the first place, which is how I broke my foot. I was judging myself for not being able to navigate those stairs on crutches. I was judging my partner for forgetting about me repeatedly when it was time to bring up food. I was judging myself for being so needy, to be feeling so pathetic about being hungry. You know, why can't you be tougher? You take 8 precepts on retreats and miss meals all the time. Why do you need it right now? Beat, beat, beat. You know, and then I was feeling, slightly special about being the injured one. And, oh, everyone's paying attention to me. You know, so I was just in this thing. And I looked out my window. And out my window, there was a road. And there's cars driving by on the road. And that was my only mostly interaction all day. I mean, my partner would come up when he could, but he was working, and people would call. But mostly I was by myself. So I'm watching these cars. And I was just totally clear that I was, like, in the me zone. It was all about me. The whole world had become my foot, this bedroom, and this injury. And I'm looking at the cars going by. And all of a sudden, you know, grace arose. And I started seeing these cartoon bubbles floating up above the cars that were driving by. And in the bubbles of the cartoon bubbles was this little phrase. Me, 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 me. Me, 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 me. Me, 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 me. And every car is going by, and like they all have these bubbles. Me, 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 me. Now, obviously, I've been up on that floor for too long because I'm seeing bubbles coming out of cars, and I'm hearing this me, 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 me. I just started laughing until I cried. You know, as only you can do in a situation like that. But it has become the most skillful means for me when I'm caught in that sense of self and the inflation and the deflation, and just looking around and realizing, wow, we are so all in this together. And then there's space and there's connection, and I'm not judging you anymore, and I'm not judging me less. And it's like, oh, not only that, but every time I think that little mental note, me, 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 it makes me smile, you know? And the smile naturally releases some of that extra anxiety around the judgment, just naturally. So, if it's useful, use it. The whole take what you like and leave the rest. Find your own way to bring humor. You know, that's the bottom line. We have to find our own way. And then we have to remember. Mindfulness is about remembering. The word sati is the Pali word for mindfulness. And what it means is to recollect our attention, or recollect, to pay attention. So remembering to pay attention to a sense of humor, even when it's grim, especially when it's grim. Another skillful means is something that I'm going to teach about in the meditation tomorrow morning. So I'll just mention it briefly here as kind of a beginning. And it's an acronym, and I like acronyms. It's the acronym RAIN, R-A-I-N. R stands for recognize. A stands for accept. I stands for investigate. And N stands for non-identification. So, when the self-loathing comes, or let's take shame as an example. That's always a lovely one. Shame. It's like, okay, here comes Mara. I can feel him coming. Kind of lurking around, trying to figure out how to get in. Pop! There he is. Shame. Total shame attack. Recognize. Ah, shame. I see you, Mara. Accept. Welcome. Come on in. Yeah, show me your face. Investigate. Well, how are you living in my body right now? Shame, you know, and oh, what are the other emotions around the shame? And, oh, what else is going on? Curious about shame. You know, then when I'm afraid of comes, curious. And then the non-identification of, oh, there's not a person in this room who hasn't experienced shame. We're all in this together. This is totally personal and totally the human condition. So this has been a key insight for me in terms of working with these so-called shortcomings. Totally personal, totally universal. So that, because it's really easy to go, oh, I heard the Buddha said there is no self, so forget it, you know, the shame. It's totally personal. And it's totally not personal at the same time. How can that be? Again, this is from the OA 12 and 12. Real humility about our character defects carries with it acceptance. We accept that each character defect, as painful as it may be, is a part of who we are. A part of who we are. So I have this little practice that I do around this. I've spent months on retreat doing this practice. And so I share it with a lot of other people, and now there's this whole collective of people doing this little random Heather practice This is how things get started. Anyway, it goes like this. It's about this. The line goes, bow to that which got me here. Rest in that which I am. And you've probably been hanging out with me long enough now during the Brahmavihara or loving kindness and compassion meditations to notice that the way that I experience the teachings is a whole body experience. And so, of course, you can just say the line, or you can use the bow to that which got me here. And then your hands open, rest in that which I am. Because they're both true. You know, the striving, the pride, the status seeking, the shame, the self-loathing, the mental obsessions, they all got us here. You know? And they served us for a time. Are they the best way that we can be served? No. Did they serve us? Yes. You know, so we bow and we acknowledge that they got us right here, where we have the opportunity to rest in something larger, which I think might be called a power greater than ourselves, as we understand it. I want to mention this last piece here because I think it's such an incredible, skillful means and for your future, perhaps, study and practice. Lama Sultram Alioni was one of the first Western women ordained in the Vajrayana or Tibetan tradition way back when in India. And she was a nun for a number of years and then disrobed and had a number of children, got married, did the family life, and now is teaching full-time. And not to get too deeply into this, I'll keep with what I really want to say. She teaches one particular practice, and it's a practice out of the Tibetan lineage. And it's called feeding your demons. And it is an incredibly useful tool for working with any of the maras, any of the demons, and particularly with addictions. And so I want to read a little bit. She has a book. It's called Feeding Your Demons. And it just came out. And I think it's a treasure. So this is one example of this, the spirit of this practice. When we obsess about food issues, long for the perfect partner, or crave a cigarette, we give our demons strength because we aren't really paying attention to the need beneath the desire. When we really pay attention and identify the deep call beneath the craving, we can learn to feed the real needs of the demon and not just indulge it or fight against it. Having been satisfied, it departs. Our demons get fatter if they are fought or ignored. And then she says in parentheses, ignored is also an active process, because they feed on the energy of our struggle against them. This is the principle behind fully attending to and nurturing rather than fighting or ignoring our demons. This is a radical shift of view. And in the Theravadan tradition, there is much more emphasis on uproot, cut it off at the root, annihilate, you know? And that is a totally skillful means. In my own understanding, that skillful means must be balanced with something like this, understanding that the very struggle is feeding the demon. And the release of the struggle and the nurturing and understanding what is really needed will release the power of that demon So just give you a little example in case you're confused. She says, this is just the next sentence. If you feed your daughter a DVD when she really needs love, she's not going to be satisfied. If you ignore your daughter or fight against her, she will become more and more obnoxious until you truly give her your attention. If we pay attention to a demanding child and give her what she needs, not what she wants, she can relax and settle down. By stopping and discovering what she really needs, you are, in a sense, paying with your attention. I could keep going. I'll stop soon, but this is another great example. When you drink another glass of wine instead of paying attention to your depression, it is not going to go away, and in fact, it will get stronger. Depression depletes you because it is eating at you unattended while you are trying to get away from it. It's like having a leech sucking on you without you knowing it. But if you consciously pay attention to your demon of depression and feed it by following the 5 steps, it will transform. So there are 5 steps, and I'm not going to teach them because this is a lineage teaching, and you have to actually have authorization in that lineage to teach this, and it's not in my lineage, but it's in the book.
What is the name of the book?
It's called Feeding Your Demons by Soltram Alioni. So, just in closing, you know, there's the enlightenment of the Buddha, and there's the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, the teaching on the middle way that I said at the beginning. There is also a second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, and it happened hundreds of years later, and I just want to mention it. Because the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma was a collective shift in understanding that every single Buddha that has ever come into being has had to pass through a threshold in order to be revealed in their Buddha-ness, which, by the way, we all have the potential. And you don't have to take my word for it either. But we all have that potential somewhere inside of Buddha-ness. And so the teaching of the second turning of the wheel of the Dhamma is the teaching of the Heart Sutta, or the perfection of wisdom. And it's the understanding that as each Buddha-to-be has passed into full awakening, and as each of us pass more and more deeply into our spiritual awakening, there is this field, and the way that it was described in the second turning of the wheel of the Dhamma is womb-like. There is a womb. It's a birth. It's a birth canal. It's a passing through. And it's a passing through, the simplest way to put it, a field of awareness. You know, a vast space. From the Pali Canon or the Theravada tradition, it says, just as space is not established anywhere, just as space is not established anywhere, so too, develop meditation that is like space. For when you develop meditation that is like space, arisen agreeable and disagreeable contacts will not invade your mind. Will not invade your mind. So when I think of humility, I think of humility in the same way. I think for us as 12-steppers that we pass through the womb of humility again and again on our journey through and to a spiritual awakening. And in this space, this womb of humility, It's the moments that we can allow that power greater than ourselves to live in our hearts and our lives, and really forming an intimate relationship with that vastness. And it's a vastness that includes our contracted small sense of self and every single one of our shortcomings, all included, moving through that womb of vast space. This last poem is from Dr. Bob, and it's from a plaque that lived on his desk, apparently, for a long time. Humility. Perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed and despised. It is to have a blessed home inside myself, where I can go in and shut the door and kneel to my Father in secret and be at peace, as if in a deep sea of calmness, when all around and about is seeming trouble. So I invite you more and more into that deep sea of calmness that includes the fact that all around and about is seeming trouble. Thank you so much for the kindness of your attention.